Welcome, friends, to the Generations Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host with you, Bill Jack from Worldview Academy, our co-host on this edition as well. And we are entering into some interesting times. Bill, you know, I bring economics into this because the Word of God speaks to every area of life, and we want to equip the man of God and the woman of God for every good work.
Oh, okay. So can I deposit $10, $20 in your bank? I know you started a bank.
Yeah, I know, but it goes belly up about every week or so, but no problem.
What?
No problem.
Okay, good.
It's funded by the FDIC, so no big deal.
I get my $20 back.
You'll always get it back, sure. Bank runs, of course, have been around since, it happened with an economist, a murderer from Scotland, John Law, who showed up in France in the 1600s, created a fractional reserve, which means effectively you don't have as much money as you're lending out. So you're lending far more money than you actually have in reserves. And eventually a big bank run, and he ran for the border. Now, the difference between bank runs that occurred in the 1600s and the 1700s, the 1800s, and the bank runs that happen now is what? Government steps in and says, here, let me help you.
Here, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
Yeah, that's the difference. Well, two major banks failed over the weekend, and this is the biggest bank failure in at least recent American history. I can't speak for earlier decades in the 20th century, but the last big upset to American banking occurred with Washington Mutual in 2008. They had $188 billion in deposits. So, you know, the Washington Mutual was a big deal. It was $188 billion in deposits. This was Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank that failed over the last weekend. That's about $280 billion in deposits. So, you know, this is bigger than the Washington Mutual failure. Washington Mutual was a bigger bank than these two banks, but the two banks put together added to the biggest banking failure in American recent history. But no problem. The U.S. federal government assured depositors of the two failed banks their deposits exceeding $250,000 insurance limit. The FDIC steps in anyway and, you know, provides for anybody who's got anything under $250,000 in deposits in these respective banks. But they say, oh, well, you know, there's a little bit more than $250,000 for some
of
our depositors.
We'll take care of that, too.
No problem. The Federal Reserve says, ha, no problem here. We'll just print more money.
Exactly.
And you know exactly what happens when you print more money. It's a reduction of everybody else's wealth in order to provide for the failed banks and the depositors in these respective banks. A couple of takeaways I want to throw out that come from, I'd say, some, you know, relatively rational minds that thankfully are still out there. First is Stuart Varney from Fox News or Fox Business. So I've lived in America for 50 years. Rarely has the news been so ominous as it is now. I go way back to the Iran hostage crisis, crash of 89, 9/11, war in Iraq. Now we're hit with several crises all at once. When it all piles up, your anxiety level goes straight up. The banking crisis burst out in public on Friday. Ripple effects still around us. Financial world's unsettling. We've seen the most rapid rise in inflation in decades, and your buying power suddenly failing. Interest rates have gone straight up. Borrowing money for a house, car, or just on your credit cards has quickly become very expensive. And here's Sean King. And I want you to try to follow this, Bill. Again, it's difficult sometimes when economists are playing the shell game. Now, you know what the shell game is, right? It's pretty hard to follow the money, so to speak.
Right.
You follow me when you're moving that from one shell to the other and you're doing the shell game with economics, which is what economists and bankers do so well these days, obviously rooted in all kinds of perfidy. But here is what Sean King has to say. And I think it's helpful to understand the immediate crisis. Now, remember, it begins with the Fed, that is the Federal Reserve, controlling interest rates and bringing them down to almost 0% and then pouring quantitative eased monies into the financial market. So it's all manipulation and stealing that starts the process. So you have to begin with robbery, all out highway robbery at every point in the American economy. You have to start there. But here's the way it works here. Number one, the Fed printed insane and historically unprecedented levels of money during the COVID-19 crisis. That's quantitative easing. Kept interest rates near zero, all while repeatedly insisting that doing so would not create inflation. To which you say, ha ha.
Uh-huh.
Okay, all right. You print more money, you're probably going to get
less
inflation,
value.
Less value for everybody else's yeah. savings accounts. Okay. And I think that's obvious. Every 14-year-old who's read How the World Runs and Your Part in It, that is our little economics book for 14-year-olds, should understand this stuff. Okay, number two, all that sudden liquidity had to go somewhere. So where's it go? Ends up in banks. Said another way, bank deposits skyrocketed. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, they doubled over the course of about a year. Okay. So lots and lots of deposits. Okay, so far.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to make sure you're following.
Yeah.
And if you follow, I think everybody else can.
Yeah, because I'm pretty, you know, I'm.
That's the logic.
Are you saying I'm slow?
Let's just move on. Number three.
Can we slow down? Can you speak slower? Okay. Can you use shorter words?
Number three, deposits rose so quickly that many banks could not loan out the money quickly enough. So what do they do with the excess? They chased yields and bought billions and billions and billions of mid to long term bonds. In short, they engaged in a carry trade. Okay, so they're buying bonds. That's what they did with the money. Number four, the Fed actively encouraged this bond buying by repeatedly promising banks and the markets via its formal guidance that it wouldn't start raising rates until at least 2024. So the Fed had promised that. Well, they didn't exactly keep that promise. In 2022, they started raising the rates about two years earlier than they expected. But then, rather predictably, all that money printing combined with totally predictable supply chain disruptions caused inflation to spike to levels higher than the 1980s. Shocker of all shockers. Panicking, the Democrats successfully persuaded the Fed in the early 2022 to go all in to reduce inflation before the election. So the Fed broke its promise, started draining liquidity or money out of the system fully 2 years before it promised. Seven. But not only did it drain money out of the system, it did so at the fastest rate in history via a combination of selling billions and billions of assets and raising interest rates at the fastest pace in history. And then eight, in a total about-face, the Fed promised that it would not stop raising rates until inflation was tamed. Then rates rising at the fastest pace in history had a devastating effect on bondholders who had previously relied on the Fed's guidance, most especially the banks who were induced to purchase all those bonds. Bond market losses in 2022 were the worst in history. Let me say that one more time. Bond market losses in 2022 were the worst in history, worse than any single year back to the Great Depression, worse than any single year of the great inflation of the 70s and 80s. The losses were staggering. If banks had reported those losses in their earnings, they would have, in many cases, wiped out years' worth of prior earnings. Their stocks would have collapsed. Collapsing stock prices would have triggered insolvency concerns. So many banks simply recharacterized a large part of their bond portfolios from marketable securities to securities intended to be held to maturity. Under somewhat arcane accounting rules, this allowed the banks to avoid booking the losses unless they had actually sold the underlying bonds. So long as they held them to maturity, no loss would have to be booked. This accounting gimmick kept banks looking wildly profitable, even though they were actually taking huge losses. Then the banks looked wildly profitable because, in addition to not having to book all those massive losses on their bond portfolios, they were earning interest rates on their bond and loan portfolios that were many percentage points higher than what they were paying on deposits, one of the widest spreads in history. The system was flooded with so much liquidity for so long that the banks didn't have to compete to gain huge deposit inflows. They were being fed with a fire hose while still offering zero interest. So while banks continued to pay essentially zero on most deposits, they were investing in bonds, yielding many percentage points above that, making them look wildly profitable. And then a couple things happened. First, big money started moving money out of the banks, which refused to raise their rates, in some cases couldn't afford to, and into money market accounts or other instruments that offered significantly higher yields. This outflow was large and growing. But under the accounting rules, selling the bonds triggers recognition of any previously disguised, ignored, unrecognized losses. So they had to sell bonds. So as the banks were forced to sell a lot of these bonds to cover the outflows of their clients, moving money to places offering better yields, their earnings started taking massive hits. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, for example, the losses it sustained over just a few weeks wiped out years' worth of profits. Because these losses were being officially recognized for accounting purposes, as bonds were being sold, the stock market reacted. Prices of bank stocks began to collapse. The only way for banks, especially regional ones, to stem the outflow and stop the bleeding is to raise the rates they were presently paying on deposits to something more competitive with current money market rates. But doing that would also destroy their profitability and jeopardize their stock values further, because it would reduce or in some cases eliminate the spread between what they were earning on their bonds and loans and what they were now paying on their deposits. At a minimum, this greatly reduces their profits. At worst, it puts some of them deeply into the red. Either way, it was not an acceptable alternative. Late last week, Big Money finally recognized what I just said in the last paragraph. It is recognized that the Fed had entirely destroyed the business model of these regional banks. Money would and will continue to flow out of them, especially regional ones, into higher yielding products, unless until the banks raise their rates on deposits, which destroys profitability and risks their solvency. The banks go defunct as a result of enduring massive losses on their bond portfolios to cover these persistent losses, or the Fed cries uncle, agrees to backstop the banks via explicit or implicit money printing and gets rates low enough that money markets stop siphoning off bank deposits. Then finally, once it becomes obvious that the business model of regional banks has been destroyed by the Fed and could only be saved by a Fed pivot, Big Money decided to call the Fed's bluff, fearing that these regional banks might fail and uninsured depositor would lose everything. They began moving their money away from these banks at a faster and faster rate. Okay, so, you know, as you hear that, I suppose at points you're lost, but what are you thinking?
It is a shell game.
It's a shell game.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And when the government gets involved in anything outside of its jurisdiction, then it messes it up.
We call it the mud touch. Yeah. Whatever it touches turns to mud.
It's not the Midas touch.
It's the mud touch.
Midas touch occurs when you have private investment, when you have private ownership, when you have people who are responsible for their own wealth. But when the government steps in and tries to bail out, or when the government steps in and tries to control, or when the government steps in and tries to regulate outcomes, then it messes it up.
And the more the government intervenes, the worse it gets.
Yes, and it's going to get worse because the government's saying, "Oh, we'll fix that,
and let us fix, and we'll fix the thing that we just messed, and we'll fix the thing that we just, and let's fix this too."
Here's a Band-Aid for you. You're hemorrhaging, but we're going to put a Band-Aid on it.
Peter Schiff, also exceedingly sensible commentary on the bank runs going on right now. All the banking institutions are insolvent at higher interest rates, he says. We have a bigger debt crisis now than the one we had in 2008, which was also caused by the artificially low interest rates that followed the bursting of the NASDAQ bubble when the Fed kept interest rates at 1%, inflated the housing bubble. But this time, you know, the Fed pushed everything down to about 0%, and that inflated a much bigger bubble. It's an everything bubble now, which is why we're now having a much bigger financial crisis. The free market would have purged the economy, as you just said. The free market would have purged the economy from all these excesses a long time ago. Instead of having a bubble that keeps bubbling and bubbling and bubbling, what happens when the bubble, you know, your little bubble that you're blowing for your two-year-old grandkid turns out to be about 14 feet in diameter, you're going to get soap all over everybody. That's what's going to happen. So the free market would have purged all that out, but now the bubble is just out of control, and the recovery with real prosperity is not going to happen. Economist and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers said the problems with Silicon Valley Bank didn't have much to do with interest rates. He said it was a failure of risk management. So what was it? Interest rates or poor risk management? It's really both. The low interest rates are what led to all the excessive risk taking, and so did the moral hazard of the 2008-2009 bailouts. Wall Street learned the lesson that you can gamble. If you win, you keep the profits. If you lose, the government bails you out. That's a pretty good way of saying it.
Yeah.
If you win, you get a good profit. If you lose, the government bails you out. So that's the reason for all the crazy risk-taking. Well, David Stockman also entered into this. Washington extended the bailout to the entire $18 trillion universe of U.S. bank deposits, more than $9 trillion of which are not covered by the $250,000 FDIC insurance limit. He said, pray tell, what enactment of Congress, not even in session over the weekend, was this sweeping commitment of taxpayer funds based on? You know, they stepped in and said, hey, we'll fix all of this. We'll provide a safety net for any deposit over $250,000. And that could, you know, be upwards of $9 trillion of savings or, you know, rescue for the banks. He says, technically, the new bank team term funding program, BTFP, was invoked under the Fed's emergency authorities to handle unusual and exigent circumstances by cranking up its printing presses. It will allow banks to borrow 100 cents on the dollar against the book or par value of trillions of U.S. treasuries, agency debt, et cetera, et cetera. Yet much of it is massively underwater owing to the fact that at long last, the yields on fixed income securities are better allowed to normalize. And unlike normal free market practice, BTFP users won't even have to over-collateralize their loans. He also said, don't forget that, this is the homosexual congressman. Barney Frank was on the board of Signature Bank in New York over the next last 7 years or so, Frank was paid $2.6 million in board fees, stock options, other compensation, even as he apparently saw nothing amiss during the bank's veritable joyride of growth. Frank served as a chairman of the House Financial Service Committee from 2007 to 2011, was a leading co-sponsor of 2010 Dodd-Frank Act. He led a lobbying charge to gut his own legislation in 2018. He pushed to raise the trigger for the heavy-duty regulatory harness of Dodd-Frank on the banks from $50 billion of total assets to $250 billion. Guess why? Because the Signature Bank was in the process of moving from $22 billion to $110 billion of assets. So, you know, Barney Frank pushed pretty hard for that. Well, in just a moment, I want to get back to the allegory to maybe give our listeners just a sense for what is happening with fractional reserve banking. That next on Generation. Stay with me. You know, busyness has a way of creeping into our lives. As dads, it can leave us longing for moments of one-on-one time with our sons to simply talk. And those moments can be tough to come by. I get it. That's one of our top goals for our annual summer father-son retreat in the Colorado Mountains, to provide quality time for you to connect with your son. Can you think of anything more important for your schedule next year? If you are looking for an opportunity to bond, to really bond with your son, then join me, Kevin Swanson, and hundreds of other fathers and sons from across the country next August. But be sure to register soon, because we max out the camp every year and we're already filling up. Go to ColoradoFatherSon.com today and choose one of the 2 weekends available before they are full. Lord willing, I will be there, and it will be a great opportunity to meet you and your son. This is your chance to secure the lowest price for this event. So go to ColoradoFatherSon.com and register today. And we're back on Generations. This is Kevin Swanson, as well, Bill Jack in studio. And today, just going over what is causing these bank runs. And here's a short allegory to help explain fractional reserve banking. I include this in How the World Runs, our basic economics for 14-year-olds and everybody else who wants to know what is going on out there. There was once a little country called Deficit, in which there were several banks. People would put their money into these banks and receive 1% interest. And the banks would lend out the money at 2% interest. One of these banks had only $1,000 in deposits, which meant that it was collecting just $10 per year from the interest. So the owner of the bank got a little greedy, decided to lend out $10,000, even though he only had $1,000 in deposits. He printed more money. He issued $10,000 to people who wanted to borrow money, even though he only had $1,000 in his bank. At 2% interest, now the bank earned $200 per year in interest payments, and the bank owner was very happy. However, the king of this little realm found out about what the bank owner was doing. He was not happy that this bank was making $200 per year. So the king said, I must control all the banks. I need more money to fight my wars and build my castles. I will make all the rules for these banks, and I will appoint the board members of every bank in my little country, and these board members will do what I tell them to do. The king then took control of the banks. He let all of them lend out as much as $20,000, even though each of them only had $1,000 in deposits. Also, he required the banks to lend himself large amounts of money without interest for his project. So each of the three banks lent the king $15,000 for a total of $45,000, even though the bank only had $3,000 in deposits. Now the king was happy, the bank owners were happy, and the people were happy to borrow more money from the banks. Finally, on March 26, 2020, the board of these banks reduced the reserve requirement to 0%. This enabled each bank to lend out $500,000 or even more while the deposits stayed at $1,000 per bank. The king happily received most of the money in lending, which he used for his favorite projects, including some of his stimmy checks that he handed out to the populace. So, of course, everybody was happy to receive the stimmy check as well. So just can see how everybody's so happy in the process, except for the fact that the whole system comes crashing down with that one small problem. Now, the story continues. Now, let me add to the story. Sadly, the unprincipled, lying, thieving, greedy banks lent out the money to unprincipled, lying, thieving, greedy people who just wasted it all and had nothing to show for it and could not pay back the money. When the depositors started asking for their money, there wasn't enough money on deposit to pay the depositors who had put $1,000 into each bank. But no problem. The king fired up a printing press and printed up another $3,000, and depositors got their money. Of course, the money wasn't really worth anything because all this money had been created out of thin air. Okay, so does that help you understand a little bit of what is happening?
Sadly.
Yeah.
Sadly. Okay.
So let's go over this again. Let's say that you have banks that fail and you can't get your deposits of $1 trillion. The government prints $1 trillion. What does that do to inflation?
Yeah.
It just goes up, right? So everybody gets hit again by the devaluation of their savings account to pay for irresponsible banks and stupid depositors that put their money in irresponsible banks. Yeah. I mean, I'm just talking about the free market, what should have been the free market, but it's not the free market anymore. So what happens is everybody has to suffer for the incompetence and irresponsibility of certain banks. SVP, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank made up 1% of the nation's deposits. Okay, about 1%.
Wow.
Okay, so everybody loses 1% of the value of their bank account while 1% of the banks fail. That's like saying if Walmart and Target go bankrupt or lose $500 billion in sales this year, the government will step in and say, okay, we're going to print $500 billion in money to reimburse Walmart and Target, which would be about 2.5% of the nation's GDP, and that would reduce the average wealth of everybody in the U.S. by
2.5%.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is the point. The point is everybody is going to suffer for the fiscal irresponsibility of big corporations and big banks. Now, we have a word for that. That's called robbery.
That's a little harsh.
It's called, well, grand larceny. How about
there you go. That's
better.
Not,
okay.
That's a softer terminology.
Thank you. I'm working on it.
Because I didn't understand what larceny was. It's okay. Three syllables.
Right. Okay. So as we wrap this up, Bill, I mean, we've gone over a lot of things, but let's get back to the root of this. The root of this is what's happening to the character of the nation. This is undermining the character of the nation. I think it's ultimately the character of the nation, the bad character of the nation, the bad character of the people of the nation that results in this stepping in to provide corporate welfare.
Yep.
As well as every other form of welfare for anybody who cries out, help me.
This is the government. Me. My greed is not being satisfied.
Yeah. And in the end, nobody's really responsible. It's destroying character. When you erode the character of the nation, the investors, the banks, the government officials, et cetera, the rich welfare recipients, the poor welfare recipients, what happens? When you're undermining the character of every aspect of society by these redistributions of wealth, you destroy the national economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on right now. It's also called socialism. And socialism is a program, or communism is a program, that undermines the incentive to compete and to excel. Safety nets are everywhere. It kills all legitimate and calculated risk-taking, which ultimately entrepreneurism is a calculated risk-taking, which should result in prosperity as long as there are some who are better risk-takers than others. And there are rewards for the best risk-takers of them all.
And it also leads to more risky risk-taking.
That's right.
Because people say, you know, I'll get bailed out even if I make bad decisions here.
Well, this is another segment from How the World Runs. Let me end with this. The corporation was a business shared by multiple partners, created as a separate legal entity. The largest corporations were funded by thousands of investors. When something goes wrong, the owners are not held responsible for their debts. And when something goes wrong, the government is often stepping in now to save the corporations. So instead of the corporation being liable, now the government is held liable. Or instead of the individuals held liable for their foolish decisions, it's always the corporation that will be held liable. Suppose that the operators of a nuclear power plant or a chemical plant make the bad decisions, ignore warnings, precipitate a huge explosion or disaster. According to current law, the men who make the decisions are not held personally liable for their actions. Usually the corporation will have to pay millions of dollars to compensate the community for the accident, et cetera, et cetera. But in biblical law, the individuals responsible for fires and other disasters are held responsible. Listen to Exodus 22, verse 6. If a fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that the stacks of corn or the standing corn of the field be consumed therewith, he that kindles the fire shall surely make restitution. That's Exodus 22 and verse 6. So, friends, it comes down to personal responsibility. And there are systems upon systems upon systems placed into the American economy that I think over time is relieving the individuals of responsibility. So, wow, we need to be cautious with this sort of thing. And we need to be cautious that the government isn't favoring one interest over another interest. And you mentioned this off air, here's what Deuteronomy 16:19 says. You shall not wrest judgment. You shall not respect persons, nor take a gift, for a gift does blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. So the Bible foresees problems when you're favoring one group over another, or when government subsidizes or offers special favors to certain wealthy men or big corporations. Such favorable treatment is really stealing. The scriptures call that the respect of persons. These are the sorts of things that are wrong.
Government discrimination is evil. It's not just wrong. Government discrimination is evil. And we need to start saying that very clearly and loudly in all areas, in economics, in all areas. Government discrimination is evil. By the way, this just in, I just got this news feed from the Babylon Bee, and the president, many are praising Joe Biden for his swift and decisive leadership in this banking crisis. He held a press conference not too many minutes ago, and he said, "Hey there, banks. Stop it. I mean it. Stop it. That's enough. Cut it out. Come on, man."
There you go. I wish he would have said that. Yeah. I mean, if he had said that, it would have been better than whatever he did. Don't worry about it. The government will take care of it. That's what he's saying. Yeah. Don't worry about government. Take care of it for
you. If you don't stop this, I'm going to count to 10.
Yeah.
And then he got lost somewhere around 4.
And after I'm going to count to 10, and then after that, I'm going to subsidize all your losses.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, my friends. Well, that wraps up this edition of the Generations Broadcast. I do believe there are personal applications to these things. God holds us responsible. He does. And the Bible says, whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. Now, I understand that we have forgiveness in Jesus. We get that. But don't forget, there are consequences for the things that we do. Temporal consequences for our own sins. And we need to take responsibility. God holds us responsible. So whatsoever man sows, that shall he also reap. That's what the Word of God says. And God will be sure that happens. He is the sovereign over all things. He will be sure that happens. So the United States federal government, the Federal Reserve, may somehow resolve responsibility for certain things, but God doesn't. Absolutely not. And certainly on Judgment Day, he's not going to do that, except for the intervention of Jesus Christ, who steps in for us and takes the punishment for us. But it's not as if there isn't some suffering. Jesus stepped into our place for us. There's still responsibility, isn't there, Bill? There's still Jesus stepping in and taking that upon himself, taking the punishment upon himself. It's always the liberal theologians who say, just don't worry about it. We'll just resolve you of all responsibility. No big deal. I'm sorry, that's not the way a holy and a just God handles moral responsibility. It's not the way he handles it. So, as I said, there is forgiveness with Jesus, but don't forget also there are temporal consequences for our sinful and irresponsible actions taken, and God Almighty will hold us responsible for these things. So I do believe that the beginning of wisdom and knowledge in these areas must be the fear of God, a recognition of his existence. And yes, the mills of God grind slowly, but very fine. Keep that in mind as well. This is Kevin Swanson, inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.